We'll do some food, do some oil, and then we'll sit back and watch a little TV. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one is the first day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Arguably the most important single ship in the global economy this Monday is a 26-year-old Sierra Leonean-flagged bulk carrier named Razoni. It was underway from Odessa, Ukraine this morning, bound for Tripoli, Lebanon, 26,000 metric tons of corn on board, the first shipment of Ukrainian grain that's made it out since Russia invaded at the end of February. We have talked in the months since on this program about how the war and Russian blockades have reduced global grain supplies, of which Ukraine and Russia are key providers, which has caused both food shortages and higher prices worldwide. So Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going with an update where food prices stand and where they might be heading.
In the U.S., the price of food at home, which is basically groceries, has jumped by more than 12% over the past year. Whole lot of reasons for that. A couple years ago, there was a swine fever outbreak in China, so a lot of pigs died and pork prices went up. Then Chris Barrett, an economist at Cornell, says as the pig populations recovered,
all of those pigs need to eat, and that increased demand for corn and soy and other things.
So those got more expensive. David Ortega is a food economist at Michigan State, and he says climate change is also playing a role.
We've seen droughts in parts of the U.S., the heat wave that set records in Europe, but also in, you know, other important agricultural producing regions, South America and Canada. And so that's led to, you know, less product being available, which adds upward pressure on prices.
Also, there is the war in Ukraine, which has made grain more expensive. Then there's other stuff that goes into the price of food. Fuel costs, labor costs, those have been rising too. Now, food inflation numbers in the U.S. are pretty bad. But Chris Barrett at Cornell says,
in some places, it's much worse because they have much longer, more expensive supply chains. They're more vulnerable to the oil price shocks that have really run up transport costs a lot.
Especially, he says, in landlocked parts of Africa and Asia. Globally, food prices are up by 23% over the past year. The good news is that's not as bad as things were in May. Prices at the grocery store are starting to come down a little bit, especially when it comes to grains and vegetable oils. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
From the economics of the thorny geopolitics of Eastern Europe, let us pivot, if we now might, to the economics of the thorny geopolitics of East Asia. There is no on-the-record confirmation, but there's plenty of speculation that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is set to visit Taiwan tomorrow. China is, as you've surely heard, none too happy about it, and Beijing has threatened some as yet undefined consequences. But it's worth remembering here that just as Ukraine has some economic leverage in agriculture, Taiwan has economic leverage, too, in semiconductors. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Back in the 1960s and 70s, Taiwan's economy looked a lot like China's does now. It made consumer goods for export, like shoes and toys, says Shelley Rigger at Davidson College.
Then in the 1980s, that traditional manufacturing started moving across the Taiwan Strait.
Into China, which had cheaper labor. So Taiwan bet on tech, pouring resources into engineering schools and science parks. One result? Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC for short.
Today, TSMC is just like generations ahead of any other manufacturer in terms of their ability to make something that you need for the highest level computing.
TSMC produces more than 90% of the world's advanced semiconductors. If you need a super tiny computer chip to power your missile defense system or quantum computer or AI research, you're going to get it from Taiwan. Even if you're China or the U.S., Mary Lovely is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
You know, the metaphor that people use is the Silicon Shield. You know, Taiwan has made itself indispensable to both sides.
But recently, China has developed smaller and more sophisticated semiconductors, and Congress just approved $52 billion to subsidize domestic chip making. Still, David Sachs with the Council on Foreign Relations says Taiwan has an edge.
A lot of the knowledge about this incredibly intricate, delicate process is by the engineers themselves who live on Taiwan.
Engineers that the government makes every effort to keep on the island. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the first day of August, it's kind of a snooze. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oil and gas prices, while still high, yes, have been trending down the past 6 or 8 weeks. But back in March, as the Russian invasion of Ukraine was starting the spike in energy prices, President Biden spent a lot of time in front of the cameras trying to convince people he was doing what he could to bring prices down. And one of the things he was fond of pointing out was that the oil and gas industry has 9,000 permits to drill that it's not using. In other words, 9,000 chances to increase the supply of oil and gas and thus drive down those prices. Now, to be clear, Biden is not wrong about that number. But using it as evidence that energy companies are sitting on their hands to keep prices high? Well, that needs a little bit more context. So we sent Marketplace's Andy Euler out to Midland, Texas, deep in the heart of oil and gas country in the Permian Basin, to drill down on it for us.
I met up with Patrick Cohorn in downtown Midland just after 8 a.m. on a recent weekday. He's the operations manager at a relatively small energy company called Henry Resources. We hopped in his big red pickup truck and he told me to settle in. After about an hour on a two-lane highway, we parked on a hill just north of the town of Rankin, where Henry's crews are fracking for oil.
So, this is a map of our acreage.
He's pointing to between 6 and 7,000 acres all told.
This is where we're parked, right here on the edge of this big frack pit.
It's basically a big pond of water that'll be used to help force oil out of the ground.
Everything in yellow is acreage that we own and operate.
Now, this is all private land, which is where 90% of the oil produced in the U.S. comes from, and almost all of the oil in this part of Texas. Those 9,000 drilling permits President Biden mentioned allow companies to drill on federal land.
You know, if the federal government is complaining about, you know, 9,000 leases not having anything done with them, well, that's just a very small fraction of the total amount of leased acreage out there.
Hugh Daigle worked in the oil and gas industry for 5 years. He now teaches petroleum engineering at the University of Texas.
What the administration is doing is they're trying to do what they can with what little leverage they have to try to get oil and gasoline prices down.
Out here in the Midland Basin, a whole slew of ranchers own the rights to the oil underground. And Patrick Cohorn at Henry Resources says his land and legal crew started acquiring mineral leases to tap it in 2016.
It took us all of probably 3 to 4 years to consolidate enough acreage to start drilling to begin with.
But before they could start drilling, they had to negotiate with the folks who own the land, who aren't necessarily the same people who own the mineral rights.
So you get the mineral position leased, then you have to go to the surface owner and negotiate good terms and a good understanding of how you're going to use his surface and make him happy so that you can come out here and start doing all the stuff that we have to do to get to and from our wells.
He says first you have to build the roads to get your crews and equipment out there. Even then, getting oil out of the ground takes time. And wells that have already been drilled need to be maintained. Up until a couple of months ago, this well was producing a good amount of oil. Then an electrical submersible pump, an ESP, got sucked down into the well.
So those guys are tripping in and out to go in and try to latch onto that ESP and pull it out. It's almost like Johnny Cash's Cadillac. We get it one piece at a time.
And it's been a slow process. Subcontractors are so busy they can only make it out to this well every so often, which means Henry Resources have been standing by with an unproductive well for 2 months. Cohorn says labor is in such short supply in the region that stories like this are common.
Most of the time it's rented equipment. We bring in a vendor. It's their drilling rig, their frack crew. They outfit with their own workforce to make the work happen, and we're just there as oversight.
He says not only is labor in short supply, steel pipe and other equipment is on back order for months, and the sand and water necessary for fracking are hard to come by too. And any company that wanted to start drilling on those 9,000 federal leases would face the same problems. Closer to downtown Midland, Mike Eastman is driving around a frack site to see how things are progressing. He's the CEO of a company called Tall City Exploration 3. And he says right now, even if he could get the upfront cash he needs to drill more wells, it's unlikely he could make it happen.
If you came to me and said, Mike, here's $100 million. We're a company running two rigs. Here's some money. Go get a third rig. I can't get the pipe. I can't get the people to do the work.
Eastman says he really doesn't like the way that the Biden administration talks about his industry. Like when the president points out that some of his competitors are sitting on 9,000 federal land leases that they haven't drilled yet.
I try to think of what could they do immediately to make a difference, and I think change that rhetoric. That's an easy thing to do.
He knows that changing the tone in Washington won't get him the steel pipe, sand, and laborers he needs for his rigs. But this is a really profitable business, especially with West Texas Intermediate trading at close to $100 a barrel. And the bottom line is, if people like Mike Eastman and Patrick Cohorn could drill more, they would. In Midland, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Despite inflation and honestly a terrible, terrible summer for airlines so far, demand for travel is still real, real high. So we figured this would be a good time to check in with Manu Power. She co-owns SeaQuest Hawaii. They do boat and snorkeling tours in Kona. Hey, Manu, it's Kai. How are you?
Hey, Kai. I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, did you hit that little red button? You ready? We can just jump right in.
I hit that little red button.
All right, well, good. So look, how's business at SeaQuest Hawaii these days?
Business is actually really great. We've had a lot of tourists to the state.
Yeah.
We're just hindered by the same problem everyone else is, which is, you know, a lack of staffing.
Lack of staffing. And I also imagine, you know, just to some degree that there's a COVID element because, I mean, look, I'm getting ready to go on vacation here and I'm like masking everywhere because if I get sick, we got to cancel the trip and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That has to happen to you.
That happens to us almost daily. So we've had to sort of work out this evolving policy where we're trying not to penalize an individual who may have, you know, contracted the virus, but also to sort of protect ourselves.
Yeah.
So now we're requiring a clinically administered test, and then we're offering a partial refund, which is, you know, more than most are doing, but we're trying to be as fair as we can during these strange times.
Yeah. Are you running it? I mean, cancellations aside, are you running at capacity or are the cancellations keeping you below what you could be doing?
We're running at about 65% capacity. That's because of staffing. We're sold out days in advance, again, because we're limiting capacity due to a lack of captains, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're incredibly selective about who we hire, which isn't helping us, obviously.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, we have to maintain a certain standard and we're willing to take the financial hit in order to do that.
Let me ask you a couple of businessy questions. First of all, inflation, it's the story. Gas prices, gas is an essential function of your business. I don't know if you run diesel or special boat fuel or what, but it's got to be killing you.
It is. We try to run the cleanest engines we can. And for the first time ever, our gas bill, which comes bi-monthly, hit five figures.
Ooh.
When I opened up the email, I gasped out loud. The bottom line is, inflation cuts directly into the profit margin. But it's just not something we want to pass off to the customer. So we're willing to take that hit and just be incredibly mindful during this time.
You should take no business advice from me, but that doesn't seem tenable over the long haul. You guys taking the hit, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not. And so we revisit the thing that you and I have talked about on, you know, multiple occasions, which is
diversifying. Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's killing us.
Yeah.
It's food, it's gas, it's labor. The shortage of housing out here in Hawaii is unbelievable. And it's the most expensive state to live in. So we had to give our employees an across the board raise because that's the right thing to do. So yeah, it's hurting us tremendously.
So, look, we've been talking off and on, probably a couple of years anyway. And it seems to me that every time you are banging your head against the wall about something. And this question comes from a guy who does not have the entrepreneurial spirit, right? Which clearly you and your husband, you run the business together. Clearly you two do. But let me, has it ever occurred to you to just say, screw it, we're done. Can't do this anymore. I'm going to go raise goats or whatever.
It's funny that you should mention that, because we actually sold our home recently that we had struggled so hard to hold on to during the pandemic.
Yeah, you told me about that. I remember that.
Yes, it was an emotional day, but we went ahead and bought a farm with some goats.
With goats, really? Oh, that's too funny. Sorry.
Actually, with goats, lambs, chickens. It's a veritable zoo around here, and that, you know, isn't even counting my own children. So we're trying to find a more self-sustaining lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge every day, but we're gonna keep going, because it's a good product and it's something we can wake up and feel good about. It's not snake oil.
Mm-hmm. Manu Power, she and her husband own and run SeaQuest Hawaii out in the islands. Manu, thanks a lot. I really appreciate talking to you.
Anytime, Kai. Nice to talk to you.
Coming up,
he crossed a group of bears and an angry mother, so the bear mauled him.
Yeah, but how did it look on TV, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial down 46 points today, about a 10%, 32,798. The NASDAQ down 21, almost 0.2%, 12,368. The S&P 500 off 11 points, nearly 0.3%, 41.18. Matt Levin was telling us about Taiwan and semiconductors. So how about some semiconductor stocks? Huh? You say that 10 times fast. Intel was up 1.7%. NVIDIA gained 1.5%. Broadcom found about a 10%. Heard from Mariel Segarra about the long-awaited grain shipment out of Ukraine. So let's look at some food stocks, shall we? Cisco, they distribute to restaurants, was up 1.3%. Albertsons, basically flat. General Mills grew 1.2%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Listen to this. And then repeat after me. Financial conditions are loosening. 10-year T-note, 2.58%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have been reporting for a good long while on the fall of the shopping center, shopping dollars having migrated elsewhere. We report now on the rise of the strip mall. Macy's is the latest retailer to announce it's going to grow its presence at strip malls through its smaller footprint concepts, which are called Market by Macy's and Macy's Backstage. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
The retail world has its own food chain of sorts. Commercial real estate investors tend to pour money into what retailers want. Retailers tend to pour money into what consumers want. And Christina Boney, a retail analyst at Moody's, says what consumers want is low-stakes, low-commitment shopping.
How far you have to walk, from where you park, how you get to the store itself, the ease of entry. Those things are just much more conducive in a strip-like situation than as opposed to a mall.
Strip malls make it easier for people to pop in and not just buy, but also return items. And they lend themselves to perhaps not popping in at all. Brandon Sveck is the director of retail analytics at CoStar Group.
One big driver, certainly, I think, is the acceleration of buy online, pick up curbside,
which has been one of the shopping hallmarks of the pandemic. His proof that it's boosting interest in strip malls, Sveck says the current strip mall vacancy rate is at 8%.
That is well below even pre-pandemic levels and is at its lowest level since before the great financial crisis.
But not all strip malls are created equal. There's an equation that makes them work. Connor Flynn is CEO at Kimco Realty, which owns about 570 open-air shopping centers across the U.S. He says a good strip mall starts with a good anchor tenant, big names like Macy's or Target that drive traffic and reliably pay rent.
And then what you try and do is have the best coffee person in the morning, you know, the best sandwich shop for lunchtime.
Then add in a gym, hair salon, and urgent care center.
And you continue to sort of build out a suite of services that'll drive traffic at all points during the day.
Malls used to be about going to a destination or socializing or having some kind of experience. Now they're more about checking everything off your to-do list. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Yes, sure, we all can and do watch stuff on devices of all sizes. Phones, tablets, laptops, you name it. But sometimes you just want to sit down on the couch and watch TV on an actual TV. And the newest of the new TVs, the ones in 4K, ultra high def, they're getting more and more affordable and are in more and more of our homes, as many as 44% of TV-owning households as of last year. But are they maybe too high def? I talked to Lane Brown about that. He's a features writer at New York Magazine.
My old HD TV had died, and I bought a new ultra high definition 4K TV, which is four times as sharp. And maybe naively, I expected every movie to look four times as good.
Right.
And it wasn't exactly the case. You know, some things looked incredible. You know, movies like 2001, A Space Odyssey, Blade Runner. And then I watched movies like The Revenant and Godzilla vs. Kong and Marvel movies like The Avengers Endgame. And I found that anything with CGI just really did not look so good.
All right. Well, not to pick on Leo and The Revenant, but let's pick on Leo and The Revenant.
Sure.
You cite specifically the bear scene.
Right.
So, number one, set that up real quick. Remind people what the bear scene was for those who haven't, you know, blessedly for them, seen that movie. And then what happened when you saw it on your whiz-bang new TV?
Okay, so in the movie, Leonardo DiCaprio plays an explorer named Hugh Glass, who is sort of, you know, cavorting through the modern-day Dakotas, but he's in the 1800s. And unfortunately for him, he crossed a group of bears and an angry mother, so the bear mauled him. The bear was actually computer-generated.
Right.
It would have been impractical, presumably, to have a real bear maul Leonardo DiCaprio on camera. And so they, you know, in movie theaters and on my old television, the bear looked, you know, photorealistic, perfect. And that scene was just completely terrifying. On my new TV, though, I expected it to look great as usual. Yeah. But I saw that the bear looked a little soft, a little bit blurry. Like it looked, I would say, like jarringly out of place.
Okay, so here's the business model question. We now have on the consumer end 4K televisions, which can be had, you know, at a not great expense, especially compared to where they were, you know, 10 years ago, right? We as consumers can buy these great new TVs. One has to imagine that Hollywood now understands that we can see stuff better than they made stuff, if that makes any sense. So how do you square that circle?
Well, you would think so. Like, suddenly we have these TVs that are four times as sharp, and they're, like you said, extremely cheap. I bought my 4K TV for about $600, which is half of what I paid for my HD TV 13 years ago. But, you know, oddly, Hollywood is rendering movie special effects at a resolution that is basically designed to look good on your HD TV. I think eventually Hollywood will figure out that they're going to have to render special effects at higher resolutions. It's going to cost a lot more money.
Yeah.
But, you know, they may also realize that maybe it's better to use special effects a little bit more sparingly than they have.
Hmm.
And, you know, movies that use effects subtly are, you know, this problem isn't quite as pronounced.
It seems like we're being hoisted on our own technological petard.
More or less, yes. It's funny. It's almost like if like the new Apple earbuds came along and they cost a quarter as much as right. They used to, and they let you hear sound much better. And then all of the music that was recorded digitally over the past 20 years,
right.
You know, sort of not as good. But all the music that was recorded to tape, you know, with analog equipment, which is sort of designed to sort of match up to this level of scrutiny, that would sound better.
Lane Brown, writes at the New York Magazine, writes in Vulture recently about 4K TVs and why sometimes they don't look so good. Lane, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Kai. I appreciate it.
Final note on the way out today, a somewhat grim global warming update. Amazon released its annual sustainability report on this Monday. The company's carbon emissions were up 18% last year from 2020 because we were all ordering more stuff online as we worked our way through the pandemic. Amazon has promised to be carbon neutral, by the way, by 2040. Oh, yeah, Amazon's an underwriter, in case you missed that. All right, we're leaving. Here's your moment of economic context. 41 years ago today, a sea change in the music and television industries, MTV, went on the air. Hey, you feel old yet? Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guillaume, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.